Hello from Patricia Glynn and Storycatcher. Ryan Blumenthal is arguably South Africa's best-known forensic pathologist, not only because he's published a couple of books about his work and dozens of articles and papers, but because he doesn't miss an opportunity to speak about his profession with people in the media like me, even if that means meeting at his home on a Saturday morning after a seven-day week of long shifts. And that's because, as you'll hear, Ryan is on a kind of messianic mission to give us what he calls lessons for the living from the autopsy table. After 25 years and 15,000 autopsies, think on that, 15,000 autopsies, he believes that if we could see why and how most people land up in his hands, and especially why they commit suicide, that's of particular interest to him, we would live with more care, more thought, more love, and less selfishness and fear. Before we begin, please be warned that this chat is not for the ultra-sensitive and squeamish, though Ryan and I did try and avoid the really gory cases he's dealt with. So if you're one of those folk, perhaps head for one of Storycatcher's happier stories. There are plenty to choose from. First, though, the matter of autopsies versus post-mortems. I have never understood the difference between them, if there is one, and I don't think I'm alone in my ignorance about that.
Well, it has to do with the degree of dissection. For example, a post-mortem could just be an external examination after death, whereas an autopsy is more invasive. There's more evisceration, dissection, etc. So a post-mortem is merely after death examining the body. So it has to do with the limits with which one sets the examination. So an autopsy, there's nowhere to hide. It's a full examination from top to toe with all special investigations. It is the most extreme examination in entire medicine.
So there's no way you would do an autopsy on a beach if you found a dead body. You couldn't do it there because you'd need all the tools that you'd have only on a, say, slab.
Right, so this comes down to the question of a resource-limited or resource-constrained environment. For example, I've been to medical-legal laboratories around the world that are fancy-schmancy. They have every single device and gadget. Some facilities have got MRIs and CT scans. You know, we've got an X-ray machine. So we have to be innovative. We have to do everything with nothing. So it's almost like, at times, wilderness medicine, where you do what you can with what you got, where you are with what you have. Sometimes you've got the state-of-the-art toxicology laboratory, whereas if I open the stomach and I see small pepper-like granules with a chemical-like odor, I almost know this is Temec or Aldicarb. There's almost no reason for me to even send away toxicology because, I mean, I'm just seeing, smelling, and because I've seen so much of this stuff, I know exactly what this looks like. Obviously, you want it confirmed in a laboratory, but if you don't have a functioning laboratory service, you have to find other ways of making the diagnosis.
What comes through your books is tremendous compassion for the people who come through your hands. Now, I know that that must be quite hard simply because I spent 3 days in a mortuary shooting a documentary. What alarmed me, Ryan, was how quickly the people lying in front of me weren't people anymore, they were cases. And I got thoroughly caught up in the bullet went in here and came out there, but it couldn't happen. And that, as I say, alarmed me. What do you have that keeps you alive to the fact that these are human beings, but without being traumatized deeply by what you're seeing and experiencing?
Right, so I'm going to defer to a quote from one of my heroes, a guy by the name of Professor Lester Adelson. He's one of the great fathers of forensic pathology, and knowingly and unknowingly, many forensic pathologists around the world have been influenced by his teachings. So he said the following three quotes, which stand within me till today. So the first one is, when we see families, we see their guilt, their grief, their greed at times. And when we see people's naked bodies, we also see that everyone has the same red blood, and tears lost for loved ones are equally salty. You don't become hardened to death, you become more sensitive to it. And this field should never become mechanistic. I mean, everyone that loses a loved one, and we all will lose loved ones, have to go through the stages of mourning. And you've got to be sensitive to this. For every single person, it's the first time that they're having to see what forensics and forensic pathology is all about. And we have to be sensitive to that.
Yeah, but you're a scientist as much as you are a human being, and you're working in this extremely exciting profession. It is so exciting when one reads your books. So how do you keep that humanity alive in you and at the same time protect yourself from the dreadful, dreadful things that you're seeing? What are your psychological, where is that wherewithal? Do you know?
All right, so look, it's about training. So we trained for this. We trained very well. I'm more worried about detectives and cops that are just thrown in the deep end that haven't had the proper training. Your training is what makes you survive the messy, muddy, bloody, smelly, charred, cooked, raw world of the mortuary on a day-to-day basis.
You talk about the care with which you have to approach a body because it might be lethal to you. Tell us about the guy who arrived in his wetsuit, having died in the ocean.
Well, there's many, many, many. I've got a quarter of a century of cases to discuss, but this work is not for everyone and it's dangerous. And we've lost forensic pathologists and colleagues from all the risks. My second book, Risking Life or Death, is about all the ways forensic pathologists can die and have died, and all the risks that are open to us, from infectious risks to sharp force trauma risks to radiation risks to chemical risks to that case of the scorpionfish inside the wetsuit of that person that died. So you never know what you're going to find. I mean, we've had fully cocked and loaded weapons fall out of bodies. You never stick your hand in a pocket. You always pat down a pocket. There could be open needles inside pockets.
You said once that you've got a technique to protect yourself against what homeless people carry around.
Oh, yes. So, look, we do get people of no fixed abode that come in, obviously, dead, a sudden unexpected death of an adult, and these are the unwashed, and there's going to be ticks, fleas, and lice on them. So if you do an autopsy immediately on them, you will be covered in ticks, lice, and fleas. So we have developed this technique where you keep them in the refrigerator for 2 to 3 days just to kill all the ticks, lice, and fleas before you do the autopsy.
You see, I was determined that we weren't going to go too much to cases because I wanted to understand the more profound things about your profession. What happens? We've gone to cases because we have become, as a population, we've become addicted to true crime. We've become addicted to this kind of messy, murky stuff. And it must have affected the way your profession is viewed.
Well, I think our field has undergone a radical transformation. Remember, back in the day, forensic pathologists worked in the basement of hospitals, you know, grim, dark basements of some hospital. Nowadays, it's a fully respected profession. Some of the autopsy suites that I've seen internationally are world-class. I mean, buildings made of glass and mirrors where you can see out but you can't see in, and I mean, architectural masterpieces. So we're out of the basement, at least. And I think things are looking up.
They surely are. And true crime series nowadays can't have hurt the image of pathologists either. They've been given a major makeover. And the script writers give them key roles to play in the solving of crimes, which, of course, they've had in real life all along, but haven't been credited for. In the end, though, successful forensic pathology rests on keen and meticulous observation and analysis. And you can't get that from a machine or a lab. Ryan has written about some of the cases which demonstrate this. Let's start with how you know whether a hanging is suicide or a murder.
Okay, I can't give all the tricks of the trade away, but I just want to sensitize your listeners to one or two points. Number one is that any single case can be murder. So even if it's the most sickly looking, wasted, cachectic human being with disseminated cancer or whatever, TB, I mean, on the face of it, it may look natural, can be a murder. The second thing I need to sensitize everyone to is that any single case can have a toxicological substance on board. Any single case can have a drug on board, whatever agent or drug. That's why when a case presents to itself to us, you have to have the largest open mind, the widest differential diagnoses, because you just don't know what you're dealing with. We go to the scene. The doors are open. The house is totally messy. Her dog is missing. The fridge is open. Everything is ransacked. It looks chaos. And there she is lying half naked on the floor in her bedroom. On the face of it, this looks like breaking and entering with a murder, rape situation. Whereas after a thorough investigation, this turned out to be natural. She had organic brain disease and she did all this by herself. She was living in a hoarder's house. Everything was messy, but it was totally natural. There was no signs of foul play whatsoever. She died a natural death. But on the face of it, it looked like a rape-homicide case.
Hmm.
The second case...
Wait. What happened to the dog?
It walked out. Dogs walk. The second case was also an adult white female. Locked house, neatly in her bed. On the face of it, it looked totally natural, but this was a crafty homicide. So, you know, we get tripped up into first impressions and what we think happened.
How did the homicide?
I'm not going to go into those details.
All right. Fine.
But just know, my main message here is that the first one, you get this assumption and you go with it and you're totally wrong. And the second one, you get this assumption and you go with it and you're totally wrong. That's why we have to work through standard operating procedures. And as boring as they are, you have to go through the lists and you'll be surprised what it throws out at the end.
There's one incredibly poignant case in which you went to a house or a room. It was a nurse whose son had apparently died, but not died. Do you remember?
Yes, I remember that case very well.
She
was
keeping him alive.
That was a very emotionally heavy case. So he had been dead for 3 months and she had warmed the room and she was still feeding him tomato soup at the time. But he had been dead for 3 months and she would not believe that he was dead. And every time we tried to remove the body or do the ocular caloric tests, etc., she would come up with some excuse saying, no, there's wax in the ears. So
what's an ocular caloric?
So that's where we inject cold water into the ear to look for nystagmus, which is where your eyes dart to see if there's signs of life in the brain. Or, you know, she would say, look, he's breathing still. Look, he's breathing. So it was an incredibly difficult case. We had to get counselors. And to remove the son from her house was a very emotionally heavy case.
You said she mummified him.
Well, he was mummified. Well, the room was warm and hot and dry.
But then he'd gone through a whole putrefaction.
Well, it's mummification. So the body becomes dry and it's like a mummy.
After a period of time, yeah. But it must have been a very smelly affair before.
No, there was no smelly affair. It was mummification. So you get the body decomposes in different ways, which is the field known as thanatology, which is the science of determining time since death. It's very difficult to explain very simply, but the body starts to break down after death. It goes through autolysis, and then it goes through early postmortem changes, late postmortem changes. Then there's the green putrefactive stage. Then there's the black putrefactive stage. Then there may be adipocere formation or mummification. So it's very complex. But in this particular case of that woman with that son, it was a dry, warm environment, and the son had mummified, and she had not come to terms with the fact that he was passed.
Oh, yeah. What a terribly poignant thing. Quite a lot of attention is paid to the matter of suicide in your book. you have read so many suicide notes. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so I think suicide notes are very clear messages for the living from someone about to be dead. So, I mean, they are so truthful. They are as honest as you can ever read. And if you want to get an insight into the human condition, read suicide notes. And I've seen hundreds of suicide notes over my 26 years. I've seen them written on paper, in neat handwriting, in illegible handwriting. I've seen them voice recorded. I've seen them video recorded. I've seen suicide notes on walls. You know, people have written on walls. I've seen them squished into socks, into the small pocket of your denims. And after reading hundreds of suicide notes, my pattern-seeking brain realized that there's only really three reasons why people kill themselves. And they are work, health, and relationship problems. And therefore, I call it the three battlefronts of life. Your work battlefront, your health battlefront, and your relationship battlefront. And if you go read suicide notes, you'll see that most of the problems fit into one of these three categories, from your hay fever to your mother-in-law. Work, health, relationships. These are the three reasons why people...
The mother-in-law. Why can't we just have the father-in-law sometimes, please?
But, Jana,
okay,
so...
Sorry, I've distracted you.
No, it will take more than that to distract me. So, you get a real insight into the human condition from reading suicide notes. I'm very wary of typed suicide notes because obviously someone else can type it, hold a gun to your head and type it. But handwritten ones, and some are like incredibly long, like multiple pages. Some are 2 to 3 liners. And we've almost got a template of what a classic suicide note looks like. And it's, tell this person I love them, I'm sorry for this, these are my PIN codes, this is whatever. So this is what a classic suicide note looks like. I think I've got like the largest series on earth of suicides. So I've been studying suicide since I started in 2001 till today. So I don't know.
Are you deliberately seek them? Or are you
No. I've
them?
Been studying them. I've did okay. 3 10-year studies. So it's almost like 30 years of studying suicides in Pretoria. So at the pre-COVID, during COVID, post-COVID. But I want to tell you something interesting that I discussed with some of my colleagues, because it is my field of interest. The greatest will we have is to survive. So to take yourself out the gene pool, if that's not pathology, I do not know what is pathology. Some people say, do animals commit suicide? And you can discuss lemmings and whales and giraffe. There's even literature on giraffe suicide.
Really?
Yeah, there's a case from the Paris Zoo where a giraffe smacked its head into a concrete wall, and there's a case from Kruger National Park where a giraffe smacked its head into the ground. So whether this is suicide or anthropomorphism, I do not know. But fascinatingly enough, the scientific name for suicide is felo de se, which means homicide of the self. And back in the day, this was seen as one of the greatest crimes you could ever commit, is to take yourself out. In fact, it was such a great crime in Britain that all your worldly possessions did not go to your spouse, went to the king. But anyway, I'm digressing here.
No, they're fascinating digressions.
So some people say the method used tells you a lot about what's going on in that person's life. So, for example, in the 1920s and 30s with the crash of the stock exchange, how did they kill themselves? They jumped from buildings. These people came down to earth. They were high flyers. They came to ground. So there's like a psychological reason. Some people... like the hangings, they can't talk about what's going on. So they're like closing their throat. So maybe there's something so unsettling that they can't discuss. And therefore, like hanging is, they can't talk about it. And then some people take sleeping tablets because the reality of their world is so extreme. They just want to go to sleep.
Hmm.
So there's a whole psychology behind suicide and the method used. And strange enough, if you look at the ways people do it, you know, for example, in South Africa, we've never seen an adult black female shoot herself. It does not exist. If we see an adult black female with a gunshot wound, it's homicide till proven otherwise. Do you know how they do it in South Africa? Self-immolation, especially in KZN. They pour petrol on themselves.
No.
That is the method of suicide for adult black females in South Africa, especially in KZN. So I'm not into profiling people, but certain people commit suicide in certain ways. Certain people would rather shoot themselves and through the head rather than the heart. And some people would rather shoot themselves through the heart rather than the head. Men tend to shoot through the head, women tend to shoot through the heart. And interestingly enough, they'll open their clothing. They don't want to hurt their clothing.
No way.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful corpse theory. when someone jumps, they try and miss stuff on the way down. Like, they don't want to hurt themselves on the way down. Most of my suicides over 26 years have had a full stomach. They go into the afterlife with a full meal. I've hardly ever seen suicides with an empty stomach. And only about 10 to 15% of people leave suicide notes or considerate enough to tell us why.
There are some incidents, there's one that'll never leave me, about somebody who was so determined to commit suicide and was a young man. He tried shooting himself. There was no bullets in the gun. He tried hanging himself with his belt. Then he actually cracked a window pane and stabbed himself to death. Is it possible to withstand that much pain?
I know about that case, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of yours. Yeah.
Look, fatal self-harm, if someone gets in mind, almost nothing can stop these people. That's why, and this is more the realm of the psychiatrist, if someone's a higher suicide risk, you know, you've got to literally put them under the nursing station. You don't want to admit them to the sixth floor of a hospital. If they've tried it once, they'll try it again. But it's severe pathology, this. And as I said, I've been studying this for 26 years. It is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, some of my heroes have committed suicide, like Anthony Bourdain, you know, Robin Williams. I mean, these people called out suicide on other people and then go and commit suicide themselves. So it is absolutely fascinating to me. To me, it's like extreme pathology.
I have to say, I will never forget a suicide victim I came across in the Joburg mortuary many years ago. We were shooting a documentary there and spent 3 days with the dead. The experience was soul-searing, to say the least. And there were two women in particular that I will never forget. So I've written about them in my story for this edition. There's a link to it on the Storycatcher podcast page. Ryan describes suicide as extreme pathology, and the victims of it are, of course, enduring extreme psychology too. Now, psychological matters have come to interest Ryan more and more because what he observes in the course of his work has, at its core, something called Locart's exchange principle. And he's very keen for us to understand what that is and what lessons we, the living, can extrapolate from Locard's exchange principle.
Edmund Locard was a professor from Lyon in France, and in 1643 he came up with Locard's exchange principle, which is the law of interchange. And in essence, he worked out that every contact leaves a trace. So if you go to a crime scene or a death scene, you'll leave something there and you'll take something from the scene with you. And then there's the second part of Locard's exchange principle, which says that the amount of transfer depends on three things: the intensity, duration, and nature of contact. How hard, how long, and what kind of contact. But then once you really start living, eating, breathing, sleeping Locard's exchange principle as much as we do in forensics, you realize that it literally is every contact leaves a trace. Every contact, not just physical, even ideas. You know, no one just comes up with an idea. They have to come in contact with the idea. And ideas ship. So, for example, no one just becomes gender fluid. They have to have come in contact with the idea of gender fluidity to become gender fluid. You can trace and track ideas back to origin. And this stuff can be weaponized. So this is what Locard's exchange principle is all about. It's how things transfer. It's contact theory. What are you coming in contact with? You don't just get sick. You come in contact with something that makes you sick. You don't just suddenly one day decide you're going to dye your hair blue. You have to have seen someone with blue hair to realize you want blue hair. So I'm sorry to say this. Some people are not clever enough to come up with these ideas themselves. They had to have come in contact with the idea. And this is Locard's exchange principle in practice.
Well, you could argue that we're all in the grips of viral memes now. But if you were to apply Locard's principle to these suicides, would you, for instance, be suggesting that those people had subjected themselves to too much contact with the wrong people?
All right, so I'm going to say this, talking about viral memes and weaponization. So I believe we live in a time now where we are all soldiers for a country whose passports we do not hold, for an end purpose we do not understand. just by forwarding a meme, you could be part and parcel of a weaponization program without you even realizing it. This is the reality of the world we live in today. We are being tinkered with, and through obviously social media, whatever you're watching, you are the end result of all your podcasts you're listening to, all the songs you're listening to, every movie or TV series, of the people you hang around with, of the food you eat, of the chemicals and glitter and perfume that you wear. This is what Locard's principle preaches, and that is your context will determine who you are and your mental health.
Does Locard's principle apply to feelings?
Well,
it does, really.
It does, absolutely, because people have been told now to trust their feelings more than facts. And you can see where this is leading in the world. And that idea has spread via Locard's exchange principle. So people are told now that their feelings are more important than facts. And this is where we find ourselves because of such shipped memes and ideas.
Right. The most unforgettable cases emotionally and scientifically, the things that intrigued you.
Yeah, there are some. I was thinking about this earlier because thanks for sending the questions, and some of them do haunt me till today. I mean, there's some, once you've seen it, you can never unsee it, you know. But I'd rather just say this to your listeners, that the stuff that probably keeps me awake at night is ex-girlfriends.
Yes, I think you're such a profound human being, but you're not.
Just a guy.
You're just, just dreadfully trivial. The most challenging cases.
We see a lot of mob assaults in South Africa. We don't like the word mob justice because whose justice is it? So that's a politically incorrect term. We prefer the word mob assault. So we see this vigilante homicide taking place in South Africa where a group of people will descend upon some unlucky victim and that person gets killed, and they get kicked and punched and stoned. And there's a lot of blunt force trauma injuries on the outside of the body. And yet when we open the body, they are virginal. They are pristine. There's nothing. There's no subdurals, no epidurals in their brain. There's no fractured bones. Sometimes if we flay the skin, so we cut the skin and flay the skin, then you can see bleeding underneath the skin, so they almost lose up to 3 liters of blood under their skin. But oftentimes you flay them and there's not much blood loss, and they're dying, and we don't know what the mechanism of death is. So they've had all this blunt force trauma, but when you open the body, there's nothing. So this is quite a mystery. This is quite a curiosity to us.
I like the vanishing projectile cases. Can you give us one or two of those?
Yeah, so that's quite a mysterious phenomenon that we've discovered over the years. Sometimes you get someone shot and then you see a gunshot entrance wound, and yet after thorough x-rays and full autopsy examination, there's no bullet inside the body. So that bullet has vanished. And there are countless scenarios where this can happen. So obviously a bullet can leave an orifice, can come out your mouth, nostrils, ear. Bullets can be coughed out, vomited out, defecated out. You can have bullets embolized through the body. It may not even be a bullet. It could be a crossbow injury, and then you pull the crossbow out and that looks like a gunshot entrance wound. We've had cases where it looks like a bullet. Meanwhile, it's not a bullet. So it's BIP, which is bismuth iodine plasma paste, which is what the ENTs use for a bleeding nostril. They shove it up your nose, and when you take an x-ray, it looks like a malformed bullet in your nose. Meanwhile, it's just gauze with iodine in it, and it looks like a bullet. Bullets can hit bone, bounce out. You can have multiple bullets in the body, and then there could be a bullet in there from a previous shooting. And now it doesn't add up, all the holes, the ins and the outs, and then there's another bullet, and you think that another bullet's missing. Meanwhile, it's an extra bullet. We've had a case with 10 holes, one bullet. A guy crawling over a wall. It went through and through the foot, through and through the lower leg, through and through the upper leg, through and through the trunk, through and through the upper arm, through and through the forearm, and then you straighten them out, and there's 10 holes. Meanwhile, it's one bullet. And then we've had a...
But doesn't the bullet lose momentum at some time?
It depends if it's...
high caliber.
Yeah, the energy. We've had cases of 9 gunshot suicide.
Yes, yes.
9 gunshot suicide. This guy shot himself 9 times in the chest. And then we've had suicides where they shoot through the head and then go and open the door for the paramedics. Or they try and shoot through the mouth and they go and open the door for the paramedics, end up in the neurosurgery wards alive. So, you know, sometimes the human body is incredibly robust and other times it's incredibly fragile. Sometimes I've seen someone just take a little punch to the chest and they have commotio cordis and they drop dead. Or commotio cerebri, a small...
I'm not even going to ask you what that is.
It's like a small blunt force trauma to the chest or the head, commotio cordis and commotio cerebri, and they drop dead. And then sometimes you see someone who has like 9, 10 gunshot wounds and they survive. So sometimes the human body is incredibly robust and sometimes it's incredibly fragile.
So, Ryan, it seems to me that doing what you do, seeing what you see every day can make of you someone who does life in a laissez-faire way or with great care.
So obviously we doctors, so we took the Hippocratic Oath or the Geneva Convention Code, which is the modern Hippocratic Oath. And as doctors, and my colleagues will bear testimony to this, we are not trained to think about ourselves. We're only trained to think about our patients, to the point that we don't even know what brings us happiness. And we don't really practice, I think, great self-care. It's all about the patients. I mean, if constant exposure to death and dying, how does this affect the human?
Yes.
So if you see that a little pimple can take you out, and some of the deaths that we've seen are so bizarre and senseless and crazy. I mean, I always give the example of a guy going to buy chinos for 999 Rand and then gets killed in a pedestrian vehicle accident. And another guy went to buy flowers for his girlfriend and then he gets killed in a PVA, pedestrian vehicle accident. And then he rocks up at the mortuary with his bouquet of flowers. And you see this totally senseless, unexpected death of a young, healthy person living their best life in the prime of their life, just taken out. So how does this affect you? Firstly, I think if you meet forensic pathologists, we are of the most positive people you can ever meet. I think just because we've seen how fragile life is, a lot of my colleagues are very optimistic people. You'll meet them. They're wonderful people. They are so optimistic. We don't really want drama in our lives. I don't think anyone wants drama in their lives.
Don't sweat the small stuff. That's the alien that occurred to me. You guys don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah, you realize that people are caught up in piffles. You know, this is the one great life that you have. And there's a poem, that one wild life, you know. So why doesn't one then become absolutely hedonistic and live like, you know, that's the flip side of this argument. I mean, what keeps us disciplined and in check? So this is where training comes in once again. Professionalism, having good teachers, teaching you how to live a disciplined life. Because ultimately, I think that is what this is about. You want the balance. And I discuss this in the epilogue of my second book. And I will sum it up here. This is my philosophy. Here it goes. Okay. And this is based on the works of Adler, Wolf, and myself. To live a good life, 3 C's. Courage, contribution, cooperation. Number one, you need the courage to carry on with the struggle of life. Because every day we see people take their lives that lost courage to go on with the struggle of life. So you need courage actually every single day to go out and live this world and this life, which is hard at times, it's brutal, but it takes courage. Number two is contribution. Do you realize that there's been 110 billion people on this planet before us? There's only 8.8 billion people at the moment, but before us, there lived 110 billion people. Of those 110 billion people, some contributed, some did not. Those that contributed left a bridge, an idea, or offspring. Those who did not contribute are gone forever off the face of the universe. That no one even knows who these people were. There's nothing left of them. They are gone, 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 swallowed up by the earth itself. So I believe you have to contribute in the way that you can, whatever way you can, in even the smallest little way. It just gives your life some meaning. And the third thing is cooperation. There are other people on this lonely crust of earth with us. If we're not cooperating, there's no furtherance of the species. So you've got to cooperate, which I prefer to collaborate. Cooperate with your fellow humans. You've got to cooperate, else there will be wars, etc. And I think those are the 3 C's to a meaningful life.
Courage, contribution, and cooperation. I like it. Forensic pathologist Professor Ryan Blumenthal, who has conducted some 15,000 autopsies in his 25-year career. His books are a distillation of his extraordinary experiences in some of our mortuaries, and they make for riveting reading. The first is Autopsy, and the second, Risking Life for Death. His next book comes out next year in 2026, and it's all about his case studies, which means it will be a bestseller for sure. Oh, and by the way, he does let out the secret of how to tell the difference between a hanging by suicide and one by murder. That's in his, I think it's his first book, Autopsy, but you'll have to get hold of it to learn about all of that. And if you're interested in what the dead have to teach us, have a listen to my letter of this edition. The link is on the podcast page. I promise it's not gory or gruesome. It's very poignant, I think. Anyhow, good to be back with you and good to be working again with audio magician Amy Moss, who pulls off some bacon-saving stunts with her editing, which is just as well. This season, we have Michaela Late on board as our social media manager, and she's all set to pull off some bacon-saving stunts as well. We'll speak in 2 weeks' time. Bye-bye.